Welcome to the Seedman Mentorship Podcast. This is your captain speaking. On this show, we navigate the voyage of life through the lens of Lakers, some who have just come aboard and others who are well underway. We will speak with experts who will show us the ropes, help us plot a course, and recount exhilarating tales of uncharted territory, all while promoting lifelong learning agility and a culture of mentorship. Today on the show, I welcome Grand Valley President Emeritus Don Lubbers. Lubbers served as university president from 1969 to 2001, making him the longest-serving university leader in the country. Lubbers is credited with the growth of Grand Valley and its reorganization from a collection of colleges to a full-fledged university. Lubbers' style as president was a combination of community and state government hobnobbing and a congenial form of open-door, enlightened parentalism on campus. We discuss the legacy of Bill Seedman, who is immortalized by the GV Business School that bears his name. Bill was a successful businessman, an advisor to four presidents, and credited with the major role in the founding of Grand Valley State University. President Lubbers shares what the university was like in the beginning, his hope for students now, and the role mentorship plays in the fabric of Laker life. It is my honor and pleasure today to sit with President Emeritus Don Lubbers, who President Lubbers, I think of you as my president still. It's been many years since I've been at Grand Valley, but I still think of you that way. And welcome, ahoy, welcome to the show, and thanks for coming.
Well, thank you, Jerry. I sort of feel a proprietary right to you.
Well, the feeling is mutual, although I will admit that as a student, I did my best to stay out of your purview as much as possible. I thought of you more as a principal than I thought of you as a paternal figure.
Well, yeah, I know. Maybe that was your mistake.
I think it was my mistake, and I think it's going to go right into the mentorship piece we're going to talk about, because I feel like you and Bill Seedman, Mr. Niemeyer, there's so many names of people that did not mentor me directly, but you created systems and you created opportunities that students at Grand Valley are benefiting from today.
Well, mentoring has several levels. One of them is a direct professional mentoring program where students and faculty or some business person or someone in a profession is assigned, and one mentors the other. That becomes a part of formal education, which I think is going to increase in importance. Not that it hasn't been important so far, but it is going to be the way of education in the future more than it has been in the past. If you look at the engineering school and the business school to some degree, they have formal mentoring programs. Students must be mentored, and that kind of an assignment is a good one because it's hard to escape from it. The second and another important way of mentoring is for the student, the young person, to just observe a professor or an administrator or someone that he or she admires, and that they look at that person, they talk with that person, and as they observe, they are mentored. That's a kind of informal mentoring, which is also exceedingly important, but it depends upon the student's curiosity. The student must be curious and want to learn from a more experienced person, so they learn through observation and maybe some interviews and questions and living as close to that person as it's possible for them to in a non-formalized relationship. So I see those are two very important mentoring systems of mentoring. You know, started in the Middle Ages, I think, in Western civilization, where people entered professions by being sent to a person in a profession. If you wanted to be an artisan or a blacksmith or whatever it was, often your parents would make arrangements and you would be assigned. And that's the way you learned a profession. I think it's going to be more and more important for the student to be assigned to someone in a profession that she or he thinks might interest them as a profession, and get into a formal mentoring program. I was always for that. When we started the engineering school, that was built right into it. And it's been one of the most important aspects of the Grand Valley Engineering School.
I like how you take that apprenticeship to journeyman to master from the. I knew you were going to get your history degree. I knew I was going to get some history lessons beyond that of Grand Valley and the Seaman School that I'm going to ask you. But and I appreciate that. Not only as they call me the captain of the mentorship, so I told Bob Stoll he was the admiral. That makes you the commodore, I believe, in naval rank. I'm going to have to check with T. Haas on that one. But that makes you part of that in those systems, and I'm happy to hear you say that. I wasn't surprised to hear you say that. I'm curious, though, about your mentors in the past and your mentees, the people you mentored, you were mentored by and mentored, and how those relationships started.
I was never in a formal. I was informally mentored. I'm an anomaly, really, because I grew up from the time I was 3 years old in the home of a college president.
Your father.
My
was
father
the
president was
of...
a president of Central College in Iowa, where I became president later, and of Hope College, and then I came back to Western Michigan. So I'm clone-like, and that was where I was mentored. When I entered my profession, I had lived as a son of a president for so long that so many of the things that were necessary in order to be successful in the profession just came second nature to me. So my greatest mentor were my mother and father. They taught me how you become a successful college president. Not only from them did I learn the nuts and bolts of the job, but they always loved the institutions they served. They loved the institution as much as the practice of the presidency. I learned that from them. It was never in a profession and how do you get ahead in the profession. It was always, this is a wonderful profession and you've got to love the place you're serving. And so that, I'm not what one would call the normal mentee, but that was an informal mentoring process that was as intense as any mentoring process there is. And of course, I observed other college presidents, but I think very early on, as I went into history, I wanted to be a history professor, and I was for 2 years an instructor in history. But I think I always really hoped that I would be a college president. But you don't train for that and then say, okay, now I'm going to put my application in It doesn't work that way. But I was fortunate in how my whole career unfolded, and that the people from the college where my father had been president and where I had grown up as a boy invited me back, and I became president there at a young age. The mentoring was essential for my success. So many people, for instance, in business, who are sons and daughters of business people, they will work in the business, inherit the business. Some of them rebel and don't want anything to do with it. If you find you can adjust to what your parents have been and are, and you like that, it's really helpful, because you don't have to go through certain phases of life that other people have, like rebellion and working your way up. But each person has a good reason, I hope, for doing what she or he wants to do. But my track, and I think there is this track in mentoring, that you look at people that you admire and you think are doing something really great, and you think about them and you concentrate on them and try to become acquainted with them. You usually are, because that is mentoring at the highest quality.
Did you mentor anyone?
Again, I think more on an informal basis. I like to think about, and sometimes I'm in contact with, people who've worked in one of the colleges or universities where I have been, who've become presidents. And they've all been successful ones. And, so, yes, I mentored them, and at times they would ask me about the job. And they would observe me, again, the observation of how it worked and how I worked. And, yeah, so they learned how to be presidents, and there were about five or six of them, and they all were successful.
I wonder what your thoughts are about what happened between the time where you grew up and chose your mentors informally, and I had a similar background. There wasn't an official or a, there wasn't a program for it when I came up through Grand Valley, but I gravitated towards people, professors, professionals that, as you pointed out, I admired. There was a spark, a relationship, and then pursued them with questions pretty relentlessly. And some of them to that day, we mentioned Bob Stoll, who we're both acquainted with. And I'm still in contact with Bob, especially now back at Grand Valley in a professional position. I go, Bob, how do I do this? Or who do I talk to about that? What happened between our original time and now, where we're developing formal mentorship programs?
Well, I haven't been around to watch it. I just have seen in the Seidman College, and in the College of Engineering particularly, I have seen the mentorship, the formal mentorship programs, grow and succeed. Where you have a formal and good mentorship program, after college, there is almost 100% employment in the field that where the person has been mentored. It's amazing. It's the way to go for employment, and that's why I think mentorship is beginning to spread, and it's spreading in Grand Valley like it is in other institutions, I would assume, because it works.
What about from the employer and the company side, when they listen to this podcast and I ask them often, I say, hey, you know, join the mentorship program. There's a lot of benefits. Mm. It's often hard to describe those tangible benefits. What do you think the mentor, who's the business professional or the company owner, why should they get involved in our mentorship programs?
Well, one of the nicer aspects of it is they become friendlier with a younger person. They have a new kind of relationship. They may have children they've had a good relationship with, sons and daughters, but this is a new kind of relationship. They're providing a program that assists this younger person, and they get to know this younger person. By knowing a younger person, you know what talents that person has. And more often than not, they find out how that mentee can fit into their organization. And so it's quite natural for them to hire the person when that person is finished with college. So it works on a personal level, and whenever we can have personal relationships that please us, enrich us, that's a plus in life. That's what life should be mostly about. And then when you can spot talent and develop it the way you want to develop it, that's another plus. So that's what I see as the advantage of mentorship.
I hope everybody's listening very closely to those last few sentences that you said, because I want them to join our program. So we won't stop for a telethon break to say call in now, but it's great to hear you say that. And it reinforces the things that I am trying to launch inside the program, and the Seidman School is backing in secretly between you and I. The university, I would like to see that as a culture thread,
yes,
within the university, yes, which I think, and now I'm going to ask you about that next, is your leadership, Bill's leadership, that gave us these tools, that gave us these structures. So we dove right into it because it was so natural, but let me back up, and it's the loaded question, right? Now I'm going to ask you to summarize for us your voyage at Grand Valley, which I know is a monumental task because you served so many years and so many accolades. But when you think about it, when you crystallize it, distill it, how do you remember your time at Grand Valley, and how would you tell the folks that don't know Don Lubbers?
Here are the major objectives. First, to have high academic quality throughout the curriculum. Work to make it good throughout. I was advised by some people, pick two or three programs and make them good. My response was, no, we have to try to make all of them good. Their suggestion was put resources into just a few because that will help them be better. But I felt, no, let's spread the resources across the whole spectrum of the institution and make it all good. So that was objective number one. Objective number two, which you said if you've read or listen to some of my speeches, I almost included in every one. It's important to be professionally excellent, but in a community of excellent educators, we have to live in a civil society. I remember when I arrived, I would get copies of memos, they weren't emails then, they were memos, from one faculty member to another, or from one person to the community, that would just be ranting and raving about something. And I came on pretty strong. I said, you know, we don't do that. It's okay to have your opinion. It's all right to disagree. But hurling epithets is not the way we should be doing this. And so I stressed the civil society was just as important as the academic society. So those were my two main objectives. A third, I considered myself an enabler. It was my job to see that everybody else who wanted to be successful in the organization could be successful. And of course, if the more that we're successful, the better I'd look. I mean, it's just kind of an easy human axiom, isn't it? If you help others and they help you, you're all going to be more successful and look better. So I always thought of myself as an enabler. Those were exceedingly important aspects of how I administered. I guess that summarizes the essence or the ethos that I tried to offer the university. And of course, the president is important. You can't say you're not important. You're not going to be the kind of a boss you can be in some professions, because there are so many traditions that keep the president from being a dictator. So when he tries to be, they kill him. So if you want your way, you have to become exceedingly persuasive. And when you say something, they have to know that's what you mean, so that over the years, they begin to trust, because they're never surprised. They may not like it all the time, but they're never surprised. You're consistent in how you function, and when you say something, that's what you mean, and that's what you'll do. And if you can't do it, you go right back and say, I said I was going to do it. Sorry, I can't. And these are the reasons why. So that's kind of it, wrapped up.
We talk a lot now in higher education, and I'm new coming back, stepping out of the corporate world. So this is new to me. It's kind of like entering into a different culture again, although I have roots. It's interesting as I hear instructors talk about the need to teach students soft skills, or what are now being called human skills. Mm-hmm. And to listen to you, because you're such a fine orator, succinctly put in, say what you mean, do what you say, admit mm-hmm. when you can't. Brilliant.
Well, I said in one of my speeches, our profession as faculty members and running an institution is sacred. And why is it sacred? Because you're dealing with people who are in some of their most formative years, determining and gaining the skills they're going to use to make a life for themselves. So that's sacred. So think of yourselves in a sacred profession. And if you do that, then you really begin to understand what a teacher is. And I think that worked quite well at Grand Valley. We did build. And even when I came, there were wonderful faculty members. The structure, the foundation was good, and it was easy for me to pick it up. We had to do things, change things, and build things because it grew so rapidly. But it was a sacred profession, and I've always thought of it that way.
Let me ask you about Bill Seidman. So other than the things that I have read that are available for anyone to read now, that's one of the blessings, I guess, with all the negative things that come with our internet connection some days. What do you want? What story should be told about Bill Seidman to today's students, not only those that obviously enter the building and are educated on the building upon which his name, you know, is etched?
Well, I'm a believer that individuals make history, that what they do and how they think is important. They're not just, you know, manipulated by a greater force to what they do. They are, for whatever reason, they are who they are and what they are. Grand Valley would not exist without Bill Seidman's vision and energy and political skills. He is the founder of the institution. He had a lot of help, and Grand Valley was a part of a greater picture which was being painted by Dick Gillette and Bob Pugh and Ed Fry and many. And then coming along a little later, Fred Meyer, Rich DeVos, Jay Van Andel. Bill was part of that energy that has created the present Grand Rapids and West Michigan. I refer to it sometimes as the Seidman era or the Gillette era, because they were leaders, energizers, pushed different kinds of projects, were instrumental in bringing some of these men that I've mentioned into the game to build Grand Rapids. So Seidman was that. In West Michigan, conservative area, people really didn't care to spend tax money. Tax money, we don't need tax money. Well, Bill Seidman was a free enterpriser. But he understood that you send your taxes to the government and they bake a pie and then they distribute that pie. And since you contribute to the pie, why shouldn't you get some of it back? And that was somewhat new to West Michigan and Grand Rapids. And Bill Seidman was one of the founders, not only the founder of Grand Valley, but one of the founders of modern day Grand Rapids and West Michigan. And then, of course, he went on to do remarkable work in the federal government, and he was dean of a business school at Arizona State. He was a executive vice president of Copper Company, you know, and he had all these talents. Bill had one of the most intelligent, rapid-moving minds that I've ever observed. He thought quickly, and he thought correctly about matters of public policy and free enterprise. In addition to this unbelievable facility to think and initiate, he could move from the abstract to the practical almost instantly. We've been talking about mentorship. He loved being a mentor. He helped more young people. And when I came to Grand Rapids as president, and he was chairman of the board, he introduced me to what I needed, to whom I needed to be introduced, both people and situations. And he helped me immensely learn the territory. I knew the territory from the past, but he updated me on the territory. So he was a great mentor to me. And I would go into his office, and at the end of the day, he was downtown Grand Rapids, a managing partner of Seidman & Seidman. And I'd come in from Allendale, and we'd sit down and talk about things. I could try anything I could mention to him. He always had an intelligent response, always a smart response, both in the practical thing to do and the personal thing to do. So I had a great admiration for him, and I think I was better in my job because of him, because he was a good mentor. And he had people all over that he mentored. He'd help them out, get them a job. I can name a lot of them. I won't take the time to do that, but they're all over the place. So he was a good mentor. He was a man on the move, endless energy. He died at 88 years of age because he'd gone to San Francisco, I think it was, to participate in some banker's meeting, and he was sick when he went. And on the way home, it really, in the airplane, I think, the infection just overwhelmed him, and he was taken to the hospital, and he died of that infection. You couldn't keep him down. The last year of his life, he really needed to take it a little more easy and solve a bacteriological situation, I think. I'm not sure, but that's the way I size it up from a distance. But he couldn't do that. He had to keep churning, and he kept churning. That was just his nature. And so he died when he was 88 years old, going at 100 miles an hour. And that was just Bill. He could not stop the pace.
The vision, I think, that Bill had, and again, anybody can go out and look at this. Two things that you triggered in my mind as I hear you speak about Bill. One is, I remember a particular speech that was recorded where the announcer comes up and says, "Hey, we have Bill coming up," and then says all the things that the pre-speaker is supposed to say. And then Bill doesn't come out because Bill's in the back talking to students. So the whole program has to wait, and the speaker comes back out and now has to ad-lib something and says, "Well, Bill's with the students, and here's some numbers," or whatever it was, yeah, else was going on in the meeting, because Bill was with the students.
And when he was involved, and he loved being involved with young people, when he was involved in something, there were no time constraints. He just do what he had to do. Then he'd go on to the next thing. Schedules were not high on his, or time schedules were not high on his list. I remember one time having a party at our house, and I wanted Bill to be there, and for some reason I don't remember, it was important to me that he be there on time, because he never was on time. So I said to him, "Bill, our party's at 6 o'clock. Can you make it?" And then, "Yeah, okay, I'll be there." And so I did that because the party was at 6:30, and I was sure that, I'd never known him be on time. Well, of course, when would he be on time? He came in as Nancy and I were finishing dressing for the party.
Well, you get some free one-on-one Bill time that way, which sounds like it was pretty precious in and of itself, Everybody wanted a piece of Bill's time, I assume.
Right, right. No, Bill and I had a good relationship. Bill moved from project that interests him to project that interested him, and he liked politics. He liked to be involved. He liked to be influential in the outcomes. So he just moved on. And he came back and was chair of our board for a while, but he was kind of a non-resident then, and the newspaper went after him. So he stayed with Grand Valley a long time. And, of course, he always was interested in Grand Valley, and he wanted his memorial service to be at Grand Valley. So Grand Valley was important to him, and I appreciated that. He gave generously himself, and his foundation continues to do so at times. And it's Grand Valley was an important part of his life, but when he felt Grand Valley was established and moving along, he'd come back and do things, but he was on to other things and nationally important things.
The second thing that triggered was a speech that you gave where you were talking about the founding of Grand Valley, and you likened it to an infant that was born to middle-aged parents as a surprise, that area of Grand Rapids. And you go on to point out the vision of some of the folks that you mentioned that look around Grand Rapids, and you'll see their names, they're the Van Andels, and they're the Vosses, and they're the Pews. The vision that Bill had, and you continued in my mind, was to involve the private sector into the support of the university.
Yes.
And that was a new concept, right? I mean, you didn't go hat in hand to the legislature and say, we need money to start a university.
Mm-hmm.
You did almost more of a matching situation where we'll produce $1 million or something you had to come up with first. But the real success, I think, of Grand Valley is the fact of how much money it does not draw from public coffers, but is supported by private donation and interest that sustains not only Grand Valley, but West Michigan as a whole. Who has that vision?
Well, that, of course, is Bill Seidman and his colleagues who decided they wanted a state institution here. And they made it a community, West Michigan community project. And that's never changed. And it would be a great error if Grand Valley became like some universities that feel self-contained and responsible to educate people, but not responsible necessarily for the community around them. And that concept for a new state institution, particularly, that it was a West Michigan community project and should be continually supported by the West Michigan community, and it should also serve the needs of the West Michigan community. That is a Bill Seidman. That's what we've inherited from his vision. And all of us who've come subsequently have reinforced that vision and continued it. And we couldn't do it without him, without that. Grand Valley is so conditioned by that it should not change. And I think that's one of the reasons our community commitment did two things. One, it made us aware of professional needs of the community and started professional needs alongside our strong liberal arts core. So I remember when we wanted to start a nursing school. That wasn't necessarily because we wanted it. The hospitals were getting rid of their nursing education programs. They wanted us to have a nursing program. Well, you wouldn't be surprised that others in the state didn't want us to have a nursing program. So it was a big political battle, but we got a nursing program. It was a big political battle to get an engineering school, but we won. We won because we were persistent and because the community needed it And it was not just what Grand Valley was doing. It was Grand Valley and the community that wanted it. And that gave the political punch that we needed to get those things done. That was very important. And the second thing, I think it... we never tried to be a little university, big university. No, never tried to be a little University of Michigan, or tried to be like them or develop that way. We were a community institution looking for how we could do things best for the West Michigan community, not to become a great research university. And most institutions that get started, the universities, they tend to like to be like the major university. All the state teachers' colleges turned universities. They all kind of like to be big, major research universities. We never went that route, though we encouraged faculty to do research. We built institutes to do research. But we were interested in serving what the community needs. That is, they need to educate their students. Older adults in professions need help in education. And I think that commitment to the community, started by Bill Seidman, had kept us on a vision. We never allowed us to desert that vision. And serving that vision made a very fine university.
What's it like for you now? And I see you get passionate. I almost want to ask you if you miss it, but I'm not going to ask you if you miss it.
No, I don't miss it because I'm close enough to it to enjoy it.
That was going to be my point of why I wasn't going to ask you, but I wonder what it's like. I described this to somebody the other day when they said, "Oh, you're back at Grand Valley. What's that like?" And I said, "I've had these surreal moments when I was walking, and it usually occurs to me between Kirchhoff and Zumberg. For some reason there by the pond, I walk a particular piece of concrete on the campus, and I have this flash of vision to a younger me, and I think about the trials and tribulations of a 20-year-old me, and I'm thinking about this arduous situation and how will I ever overcome it." And I had been on campus again in a different capacity, a professional capacity, as a vendor to the university for a while. And then I was in my 30s, and I had this same vision, and I thought, how silly of 20-year-old me. We overcame that, but the current crisis is much grander than that. Well, now I'm back again, and it happened to me the other day when I was walking that stretch, and now I'm in my late 40s, and I wonder, what does it feel like for you? We met under the arch today, once we settled on which arch we were meeting under here at the Pew campus. Part of your design you approved, by the way. What's it like to walk around and watch your vision in action?
It's one of the great pleasures I have in my life, is to watch Grand Valley and be able to walk around. One of my major tenets in administration was make the campus beautiful, inside rooms and outside rooms, because people work better, think better, feel better when they're in an environment that's beautiful. Even if they're not aware of that, it happens. It works. I know it works, and I won't cite the practical reasons that I know it, but I know it works. So it works for me, too. I like to walk around because the campuses are beautiful, and the buildings are well-maintained and well-designed. And so I walk through them, some that I participated in designing, and some that came after me and some before me. And that was another thing that that Bill Seidman insisted on good architecture from the very beginning. So when I came here, it was a very small but a very attractive campus. And it's so I was always committed to make it beautiful. So now I can enjoy that beauty. So the physical presence of the campus is very good to me. And then how can I not be interested in rather unusual that all my successors have been very kind to me. And, you know, that doesn't happen all the time. One of my colleagues who retired said that his successor gave the command to the people in his administration that when the former president came around, make sure he's sitting in the back of the room. Hmm. Interesting. Now, I've never had that. They've been so courteous and so pleasant to me and so inclusive of Nancy and me and university activities that I'm so happy we didn't go away that we... But you see, I've told you that I was mentored by people who loved the places where they were, not just the job they were doing. And I think that's the way I am. I love West Michigan. I love Grand Rapids. I love Grand Valley. I love my alma mater, Hope College. All those things. I'm happy that I was mentored to appreciate things. And so, yeah, I'm around here appreciating all the time.
Gratitude and appreciation are great ways to start your day, I think. It's well said. I know a very good tonic, at least for me, in my formative years, that helped develop my self-assurance, and I know you're a fan of, so I want to ask you about it, and it's international study. I know that you're a supporter of, you helped create programs for overseas study. How important is it for the student that's listening, that's on the fence, and, well, it's going to cost me a couple extra bucks, and I might have to go overseas? How important is international nowadays for student education?
Well, as the world shrinks, I think it's relatively important. We have a population that is not as so well educated on foreign policy as it should be. The more people who can leave their environment and culture and experience another one, the better off they'll be able to evaluate how we as a nation react to other nations. And it also it opens up one's mind. Here you are in an environment you've never experienced before, often with a language that is foreign to you, or a language that you've been studying and now you're trying to become fluent in it. You are in an environment you have never been in before. And that experience of finding out other people don't live the way you live is valuable. Number one, it could be valuable in your profession. And number two, it could be valuable in your perhaps learning to understand humility, that what you are and what you come from is not the only thing. And that there are other people who think and do things a bit differently, and they're okay too.
When you think about the legacy that you leave, and what do you want to be remembered? What do you want to be remembered for?
I don't have much of a conscious need to be remembered for something. Having said that, I take such great pleasure in being permitted a career that pleased me. And, you know, most of us are not remembered more than a little while, so it really doesn't matter. What matters most to me is the overwhelming gratitude I feel for having been allowed to live a life that has given me pleasure and success, happiness, as well. There are trials and tribulations, by of course, but I did what I wanted to do. From the time I was 29 years old to the time I was 70, I was engaged in a profession that's the only one I ever really wanted to be in. Now, how fortunate is that? You know? So, no, to be remembered is not important to me. It's just having been what I was and am. I'm so grateful. You know, we're born into an environment we don't choose, and we have a genetic makeup for which we have no responsibility. And those are two pretty, those are important. They make us in so many ways. So why should we take credit, or why should we want to be remembered? If you, with your genes and your environment, you luck out by doing what you want to do, just be grateful for that.
President Emeritus Don Lubbers, my president. Well, president, my president, what an honor to get and speak to you. And yeah. I regret the fact I didn't take the opportunity 20, 25, maybe 30 years ago to walk into your office and introduce myself. I certainly wasn't equipped to have this conversation at that time, but I wish I had the courage to take that opportunity. And I thank you on behalf of myself, but on behalf of Grand Valley and the students for the programs, systems, legacy, campus. I can go on and on and on, the things that you, Bill, and so many others have done for us. And I appreciate it, and I thank you for
well,
your time.
Thank you. It's been nice being with you. Old people like to reminisce.
Well, you, during our whole interview, you bring to the fore what it means to be the telos, if you will. There, I'll throw my Latin in there, of what it means to be a community member, not just of Grand Valley, not just of Grand Rapids, not just of West Michigan, but as society, and a call, I hear you, for civility, and the true reward, I hear you, in life is the relationships we have with each other, not the treasure we amass, not the where we leave our names, whether it's chiseled in stone right. or forgotten right. on the wayside, but on the lips and in the hearts of the people that we mentor and the folks that we touch in our lives. And though we haven't formally done that, I feel that paternal love from you, and I truly appreciate
you
and this time.
Well, I've appreciated it too.
Thank you for sailing along on this episode of the Seedman Mentorship Podcast. For more information on the Seedman School of Business Mentorship Program at Grand Valley State University, set your heading to www.gvsu.edu/Seedman. If you have a story to tell, know someone we should interview, have questions or comments, email us at gvbiz@gvsu.edu. Until next time, keep a weathered eye on the horizon, and we wish you fair winds. So long.